For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. And gentlemen, we live in a world that has been essentially cut up and divided into nation states. There's very little land left anywhere on the face of the earth that doesn't fall under one government or another. And then we have the Catholic Church, which is actually in itself a nation state in the fact that there is the Vatican, but it has a reach and a touch that comes into almost every other nation state on earth. How does the Church influence the values of nation states throughout the world, and what should the role be from a philosophical standpoint?
Yeah, there's a lot of philosophical questions underlining that. A lot of the theological questions around that. The Church, I would say, in recent time, although, you know, it's, you know, 50 years now, addressed that at Vatican II. So that was kind of, I mean, when you really peel it back.
A kind of updating, yeah.
That was the question for Vatican II. How and what is the Church's role in the modern world, which, yeah, the modern world is made up of nation states, but increasingly, I think even the modern world is trying to erase those lines and kind of move us away from a patchwork of individual nations to some sort of global community of people.
Yes, this term globalization. We also have something we're going to spend some time on today's program, as well as, and part of that maybe, what might be kind of emblematic of that effort in very recent times could be something like taking a look at like the EU, right? The European Union is this attempt to unify various nation states to bring about a kind of, I don't know, collective effort, right, across. And it's brought with it some benefits, some advantages, but some disadvantages. But we also see through various economic activity, I think, might be the most prominent or accessible way to think about globalization. We used to think about like international trade and trade agreements and things like that that come up. So globalization. And then, of course, the Church, to your point, Kent, transcends borders, right? Catholicism is for everyone. Catholicism means universal. Christ brings his saving work to all. And that's the mission. That's evangelization is one of the, if not the primary mission of all of us as his disciples. But Mark, before I get, that's kind of taking us into a theological realm. So before, or maybe we may not even go there. So let's, we'll stick with the philosophical stuff in the cave. So let's talk about globalization a little bit. What comes to mind? How might you begin and, or we begin even, when we say globalization, what sort of terms or definition comes to mind?
Well, I think the biggest hallmark of globalization is the total removal of boundaries to economic commerce and trade. So, you know, traditionally when you've got nations, those nations negotiate with other nations to allow trade in and out. And the push towards globalization is to short-circuit those governments to a certain extent and allow companies to negotiate directly with each other without having to go through any sort of bureaucratic checks and balances that would be created up by the governments, and allow companies to move freely across borders, to put, you know, subsidiaries in whatever country they want, to hire employees from whatever country they want, and to allow the money to freely flow all around the globe based on kind of the decision and whim and will of individual companies. That to me seems to be sort of the basic, most fundamental idea behind globalization.
Yeah, and with that comes all sorts of, just in the quick definition there, Mark, you brought up all kinds of things of interest, including So that economic activity, treaties and agreements, but also the flow of goods, services, and peoples.
Right.
And I think the people is all, as well as economic activity, are certainly of concern and importance to Holy Mother Church and how these arrangements are made, and the principles on which they're founded. That is where the church has something to offer.
Right. And you bring up the terms like principles and people, and that moves us into the philosophical realm of ethics. And so I think there are a lot of ethical questions that mm-hmm. have to get discussed, kind of have to be looked at. And particularly we as Catholics, I think, have a lot to bring to the table as far as the ethical ramifications of what's going on with globalization, some of the pitfalls, some of the dangers, some of the things that we should probably watch out for as Catholics and maybe intervene on behalf of other people as these sort of ethical, ethical landmines present themselves. Because globalization is not something that is going to be, I think, receding in the future. There have been a couple of political movements that seem to be a pendulum swinging back. You had Brexit, and there's other tension there to kind of break up the European Union a little bit. A lot of people look at the election of Donald Trump as a pushback against globalization. So he kind of ran on a nationalist platform, and so there's an idea that, you know, he's going to try to pull us back from this increased globalization. But I think by and large, the trends are going in the other direction, that more and more we are living in a global community, and that's just going to continue to become more of a singular entity, and national boundaries are going to become less and less important.
Well, yeah, and technology makes that, super easy to happen. I mean, I have a son who's deployed overseas, and I can talk to him on my smartphone and do FaceTime, and it's amazing because he's literally on the other side of the planet, and I can talk to him as if he's down the street.
Right.
From me. And that's, I mean, talk about closing the distance, right?
Right. But, the pitfalls of that and the ethical questions around that type of technology, there's a cottage industry on that out there.
Oh,
on
right,
how
right.
the same technology that allows you to connect with your son in Afghanistan is increasingly dividing parents and children from each other in their own living rooms.
Correct.
And so...
Correct. Exactly. It's the blessing and the curse.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And a lot of the push towards globalization seems to be that on the one hand, you have an opening up of individual liberty, but at the other hand, as we expand individual liberty, it seems to be pulling us apart more and more. And ironically, globalization seems to be a force that isolates us more than it brings us together a lot of times.
Yeah, that's an excellent point around the sort of social ramifications of what some of these efforts are from this banner of globalization, the term that we've been using. I know when I think of like globalization, what comes to mind me first and foremost is, on a positive note, I think about our ability, how globalization has the potential to unleash human potential in ways that weren't done before. So as things like the spread of, say, the rule of law, commercial activity has proven over time to bring a lot of benefits in that the sort of free trade of one being able to put to get ahead by being able to engage in commerce with others and reap the rewards of the fruits of one's own labor, to sort of begin to climb yourself and your family and through generations out of poverty. We've seen pretty remarkable success. There's the last, you can kind of Google this, but if you look at what's happened globally the last 60 years in terms of people living in abject poverty, it's absolutely remarkable at how many hundreds of millions of people, 400 to 600 million people, have been lifted out of the worst poverty that that on the planet through, again, some of this globalization, through this engaging in trade and development and things like that. But it's not without significant not just drawbacks is an understatement. There's some evils that come along with it.
Correct. Yeah, because as you've had this, you're right. You know, to a certain extent, yeah, the low tide has lifted all boats to a certain extent. But on the other hand, there's been a massive, massive inequality that has been created. So the distance between the wealthy and the poor is continuing to increase. And yeah, the lifestyle of the poor has definitely improved. But at the same time, I think the political rights and the political situation a lot of times of those in third world countries is continually imperiled, and a lot of it is imperiled because of the nature of globalization and the ability of companies to be able to kind of skirt laws of individual countries because they exist in a plane sort of above the rule of law in individual countries.
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. I think it brings to mind issues of like corruption, you know, along with globalization. Inevitably, one of the, I think, an implacable foes is these conflicts of vision. So as, say borders get erased, so to speak, we know, we look around the globe, we have, you know, republics, we have democracies, we have various socialistic type systems, we have communism. We have dictatorships, totalitarian rule. I mean, we've got a lot. We've got tribal issues. I mean, just in rivalries. I mean, there's just a lot of different, again, conflicts of vision of what the human person is, our destiny, if we have one. Are we simply material economic beings, as Marx might have us understand? Or are we, infused, you know, body and soul with an eternal destiny? How we think of, not just thinkers, but come into contact with the reality of who we are, what we're made for, can really be decisive as we approach globalization and how we assess it and how we ought to maybe guide it.
Right. So this whole idea of globalization, there's a lot to unpack here. You know, we've got issues of ethics, we've got issues of economics, we've got issues of personhood, we've got issues around immigration, we've got issues.
Ooh, that's a hot topic. Too.
A hot topic too. There's issues of technology and the role that, you know, the interface between us and technology. There's questions of our allegiance to community, to parish life. Where does religion fall into all of this? All of these questions revolve around this move towards globalization.
And we're going to have to take up those questions right after this break. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a voice for the church that's seldom heard in our chaotic world. We're confirmation for the strong of faith and encouragement and answers for those in doubt. We're there to rejoice with your triumphs and to be a voice of consolation through the dark times. We're a voice for vocations and proudly pro-life. We are Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
If it wasn't for you all, I don't know what I would do.
Catholic Radio Indy.
What an absolute blessing you are.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent.
Hello.
Kent Blanford is here taking care of us. And we are discussing today globalization. And we just talked about all of the different philosophical concepts and questions and sort of this big network of problems that exist underneath globalization. But you were talking about one, Tim, as we went to break, that I think starts off the whole conversation. And that really is the question of the purposeful life. What is the purpose of our lives? And that is a question that sets fundamentally, it sets Catholicism apart in some ways, yes. You know, Catholic philosophy apart from secular philosophy. And then it also sets the stage then for, you know, how globalization either leads us to sort of fulfill that, or how globalization can lead us away from that. So let's talk a little bit about the human individual and what constitutes happiness, because, you know, fundamentally, no matter how you look at ethics, we're all striving for happiness, but it's all a question of how happiness is defined.
Yes, I would agree. I think what I when I talk about ethics, what I use the term happiness because it's the one thing we all want for its own sake. So there's a sort of a common goal that we reach. But I also just try to also happiness, though, also it can also be understood not as ought not to be understood as simply that sort of temporary emotional state, like, oh, I'm so happy that you gave me that present, you know, and then that emotional state, you know, comes and goes, you know, our feelings come and go. But happiness from an ethical standpoint also can be understood as kind of a holiness, right? Kind of a being set apart, a kind of blessedness. I also like to use secular terms. I also think to think of happiness or the ethical is a life well lived.
Right.
In other words, to use Matthew Kelly's term, you know, one becomes the best version of oneself, and that takes time to do that. And that brings up things like habits and virtues and things like that.
Exactly. Habits and virtues, I think, are key, and particularly when we're talking about globalization, because going back, looking at the Catholic philosophical tradition, particularly writings of St. Thomas Aquinas, the happy life is one of virtue.
Yes.
And virtue is not easily won. We're not born virtuously. You know, we're not born as creatures. You know, this goes back to the idea that the man is born into a fallen world as a fallen creature. You know, we are all tainted with original sin. And so to find true happiness, we have to work at it.
And be schooled in it.
And be schooled in it. And we have to have not only, you know, human guides and a human community. And once again, I think this you know, leads into the discussion around globalization quite a bit. You know, we have to have a community around which to school us, but we also have to be guided to a certain extent divinely and through a life within the sacraments and a life within the church towards virtuous action. So virtue, to achieve virtue, really means to set certain limits for yourself.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, there's a notion of limits. And the whole idea behind globalization, I think the whole push towards globalization is to get rid of all the limits, to allow limitless happiness, to allow, you know, and that's the promise that globalization lays out in front of us, you know, that as we become connected, as international commerce becomes more and more robust, as our markets grow, as we continue to have growth and prosperity, everybody is going to have limitless happiness because we're all going to have limitless access to the whole world.
Well, I think you're right. I think you're right. And I think also within that, The dominant emphasis is on kind of economic prosperity, which, you know, if you're living in if you're living in dire poverty, you know, material prosperity is important. Go all the way back to Aristotle. We, in order to live well, we have to have we can't. It's not just to barely get by in terms of like barely stay alive, have just enough, you know, calories each day so I don't croak, but it's also not eating at Ruth's Chris every night either, right? That there's a to live well means, you know, has often meant, you know, that you're going to be able to have your basic needs met and a little bit more, such that you can have what? Well, you can engage in what? Charity, that you can engage in leisure activities. There's all these things that are freighted along with it. So the allure of, you know, economic prosperity is very, very strong and understandable to a large degree. But we also know that taken too far leads us into a kind of Marxist anthropology about the human person as only being economic, and that history is really the telling of a class warfare where that sort of spins out of control, and that at the end of the day, where material prosperity, what it's ultimately going to lack, and is while important, it lacks love at the end of the day. Economic prosperity doesn't teach us to love And it doesn't teach us how to be loved.
Right. Yeah, I think the notion of freedom plays into that as well.
Yes.
That, and I think, once again, I think there's a certain assumption of the definition of freedom that leads into globalization.
Oh, yeah.
That we as Catholics, you know, at least from traditional from a traditional philosophical standpoint, would disagree with. Once our bare necessities are met, then the question is, well, how do you live freely? And I think globalization pushes us towards a standpoint of, well, freedom is having the maximum number of choices and being able to exercise the maximum amount of choice and being able to acquire the maximum amount of goods. And mm-hmm. so it's a yeah. maximum, and this is never going to be satisfied, right?
It's a kind of consumption, right?
Right. And not only that, but it's a push towards maximalization of it.
Yes, yes.
Where the traditional Catholic understanding of freedom is a life of virtue lived within limits. So, you know, the free person is the one correct. that's able to push himself away from the dinner table when he's got that big...
Well, tread lightly there, Mark. Let's go to a different example. Well,
but the virtuous person is the yes. person who's free of not free of entanglements and obligations, and to a certain extent free of society, which I think that's another push for globalization, but is rather free of the constraints of human nature and fallen human nature at that.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, think about it. I mean, it at its root, your example is spot on. The person who can't push away from the dinner table when they ought isn't really free. They're experiencing a kind of disordered attachment to the food. The person who's truly free is this term freedom for excellence, right? Cervais Pinker, the great moral theologian, gave us. This freedom for excellence would be, I'm free to do what's best. I'm free to do what's most perfect or good in this what the situation calls for.
Right.
So the person who's truly free is the person who neither eats too little or too much. They're free to do exactly what's right. And that's what true freedom is. It's not eat as little as less you want. You know, maximum choice. I'll take one bite or I'll take three plates full. No, that you're not really, there's a kind of slavery there.
Right. And to be able to do what's right, to be able to yes. have the freedom to do what's good and just requires a knowledge.
Knowledge, absolutely.
Of what is good and what is true and what is just. And so I think there's also, within globalization, a push against traditional education. It used to be that the idea and goal of education was to bring people up in a tradition of more knowledge and more experience, whether vicariously or on your own, of justice, of truth, of goodness, of beauty. In other words, that whole liberal arts sort of tradition that came right. along. Globalization has pushed and pushed and pushed to expel that, because after all, if you're building new gadgets and you're trying to expand the economy, who has time to go back and study Plato?
Right. Well, this is where I don't know if we'll get mail on this or not, but this is where I'm a little bit critical of the broad push and seemingly unending drumbeat towards, you know, STEM curricula as like that's the only way to, you know, that's the only way to educate the human person is in, you know, in science and math and engineering. And these are good things, right? They are good things. And we do need to be educated in a deep way. But it seems to me that the exclusion of imaginative literature, the exclusion of studying philosophy and theology, the exclusion of studying history comes at a great price, because you ultimately can, what you could wind up with, and I'm not saying it has to go there, but what we're at risk of, you can have very, very smart engineers and scientists who make incredibly effective and wicked weapons
right.
that destroy humanity yeah. or large parts of it, right? Right. You want someone, you don't want the physicist who has no, who is completely untethered from the moral life.
Yeah. And
who knows what they're going
to
cook up.
And it goes back to the notion of limits. You know, when you don't have a notion of the good, when you don't have a notion of what's just, when you don't have a notion of what's right, you wind up with the sort of...
Or what people are for.
Boundless, right. You have this boundless technological progress, and you wind up with a mentality that just because we can do it, we should.
Right, right.
And so the limits get pushed, and there is no wisdom behind a lot of what goes on, because it's all done in the name of economic progress.
Correct.
If I can make a buck off of it, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, there's that understandable why there's a kind of a economic prosperity incentive in there. It's when that becomes the whole story, I think, is where we go incredibly wrong. And so it also, getting back to the moral life, what I keep hearing you say, Mark, which is goes right back to Aquinas, is that moral life can be understood the first precept of the natural law is do good and avoid evil. So first of all, right there, we have to understand terms, and then we have to recognize that some things really are good and some things really are evil. So right there begins the delineation of limits, as you've been talking about.
Right. And where we develop that, where we start to get that notion, starts on Sundays, at home, at our parishes, living a life in the sacraments. You know, living a life immersed in the teachings of Jesus, the teachings of Mother Church,
right,
so that we begin to kind of live a life. And so that, I think, is kind of the first answer to Kent's question that he started off with is, you know, what is the role of the church in this increasingly globalized world? Right there, that school of virtue is probably role number one that the church needs to increasingly play.
Yes.
And we need to take a break. We'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Most of us like to keep up on what's going on in the world and try to catch a little news each day. Did you know that you can catch the very latest Catholic news right on our website? We have news from Rome, from around the world, and here at home, updated every day so you always know what's going on from a Catholic perspective. Check it out. Go to CatholicRadioIndy.org and look for the Catholic news headlines. There's always something new at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
If it wasn't for you all, I don't know what I would do.
Catholic Radio Indy.
What an absolute blessing you are.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell. In the cave, Mark Tuttle, trusty sidekick Kent Blanford. We've been talking about globalization, and right before the break, Mark, you brought up something very important I want us to pick back up. Where we left off, and that is, what role, I want to ask you this question, what role do you see Holy Mother Church playing in this arena of globalization?
Well, where we left off was as that school of virtue, that, you know, we have to have our lives anchored individually. We have to have our lives anchored in the sacramental life of the church, because that really is our greatest encounter, we believe as Catholics, with the true, the good, and the beautiful. Now, that's not to mean that just sacramental life in itself replaces an education. You know, I think there's a call for us as Catholics to push for a traditional understanding of education as well. And that is, you know, an education in the classics, an education in the humanities that teaches us limits, because that's what globalization is continually trying to erode, is that idea of limits. And it's pushing this idea of limitless progress that...
That's the P word. Yeah.
Right. You know, eventually we can expand technology, we can expand the world economy, we can expand, you know, the ability of human beings, to the point where, you know, we're going to bring unhappiness without us having to limit ourselves. Right. And I think as Catholics, we're called to counter that by going back and saying, no, we need to educate ourselves in human nature. We as Catholics understand human nature, I think, better than anybody else. And so, I mean, I'm sounding a little bit, you know, like I'm bragging on Mother Church here. It's not to say there's other religious traditions that don't also have a grasp of this, but I think we as Catholics need to bring it to the forefront, interface with other faiths. I'm thinking particularly Judaism. I think Judaism is a strong trend towards a understanding of human nature where, you know, we are limited by sin. We are limited by concupiscence. You know, I think we've got a lot of commonalities there with other faiths, but I think we as Catholics are positioned to be able to kind of bring that into the modern world.
Yeah, I think there's I think the way I've heard it termed before might sound familiar to listeners is the Catholic faith has the fullness of truth. So we can find truth, some truth outside the church, but to the extent it's outside, the truth always belongs to the church, wherever it's found. And so this proper understanding of human anthropology, the human person, our destiny, those are super important because it's going to help organize and prioritize our other thoughts. I mean, in this pursuit of wisdom, I heard this definition years ago, and I really thought it was, and this is where I think the church makes a contribution, an understanding of wisdom. And the definition I heard was that wisdom was the most perfect knowledge of the most important things in their proper order, and then a permanent disposition to live in accord with that truth.
Right.
And so if we're going to, and it's this possession, and we know wisdom itself ultimately is who? Christ our Lord. And so we need to grow in knowledge and perfect our knowledge of things. We have to order our lives and order our values even have to be prioritized because often values can come in conflict, you know, through, different choices or settings that we're in. And so we have to know what are the most important things and what are sort of secondary or tertiary. And then we have to live in accordance. We have to develop that permanent disposition is the life of virtue. Living in accordance with these truths as we've come to understand them. And you can see how when we mention happiness, happiness not as, again, as that temporary emotional state, but rather happiness, especially going all the way back to Aristotle, was always understood as achieved really at the end of one's life because it's only then that you can look back over the totality of your life and truly assess, hey, did I make the most of my potential? Did I capitalize on my opportunities the way I should? Did I become the person I should have become? Did I love others in a sacrificial way? And how did I make progress in the moral life? That's how at the end I can determine whether or not I'm truly happy, really reach an abiding, deep kind of happiness, this life well lived. It's also why we don't canonize anyone until what? Well, till after they've died,
right?
Because there's this trajectory that we should be on.
You know, I think when it comes to happiness too, there's another reason that we hold off judgment, and it has nothing to do with moral character. It has to do with the externalities around a person's life.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the classic example of this is it's brought up by Herodotus. In his histories, he talks about King Croesus of Lydia, and he was the richest man. Actually, I think Forbes magazine went and found out that truly King Croesus was the richest man ever to
when you adjust for inflation.
When you go back and you look at the control of the world's wealth at the time. King Croesus controlled more wealth than any other person has.
Yeah,
and Solon, who is the lawgiver to the Athenians. King Croesus asked him, well, who's the happiest man? And Solon kind of, you know, he talked about, I think, about a happy shepherd that he knew, mm-hmm. talked about that, but had recently died. And he talked about another family that had recently died. And King Croesus, you know, was kind of insistent. Well, why aren't you saying I'm the happiest person? I'm wealthy. I mean, look, who could be happier than I am? And Solon explained to him, you know, look, you can't pronounce somebody happy until you know how their life is finished.
Right.
Well, unfortunately for poor King Croesus, how his life finished is he was conquered by King Cyrus of Persia, was enslaved, and wound up losing all his wealth.
Oh.
And he died as you know, pretty much the court slave for King Cyrus. So he didn't die a happy man, and at his death, King Croesus remembered the lesson he'd gotten from Solon on that. But you know, none of that had to do with King Croesus's moral character, and nothing to do with his ethical standpoint. It had everything to do with sort of the external around him. And so I think, you know, that plays a large part into it. And that's another place where the church, I think, has a role. One notion that we bring to the table that other philosophical traditions don't is sacramentality.
Yes.
You know, when we talk about wisdom, when we talk about virtue, when we talk about ethics, those can be very ethereal types of subjects. But we as Catholics are called to bring them down to earth. We're told to live a life that is sacramental. It's bringing the divine, it's bringing the philosophical to a certain extent into everyday practical life. And so that, I think, is another way. And that begins to affect more than just us individually. It starts to permeate through our families, and it starts to permeate through the community life that we create centered around parish life.
Right. I think I'm glad you brought up communities, because I would say, you know, one of the features that has tended to come along with globalization is it's an erosion of tradition. Tradition understood as that which has come before and that we simply receive as being born into a certain community in a certain time in a certain place. Progress tends to, again, a dominant feature of globalization. Progress, to me, seems to be a sword that's used to cut off us from tradition, from the past, because it so highly favors the new, right? The innovative,
you know,
and really disparages or wants us to be cut off from that which has come before.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest images of that is a tension that a lot of people, too many people, I think, feel. And that is the tension between where the ideal place for you to live is. You know, the Mother Church says the ideal place for you to be on a Sunday and the ideal place for you to pattern your life around and have your life revolve around is the church. You know, that's really where you belong and all of that. Increasingly, our professional lives are telling us, no, the ideal place for you to be is at the airport. It's flying to your next business meeting or flying, you know, flying across the globe.
Or on my iPad.
Or on your iPad, exactly. But nonetheless, completely 100% disengaged from your community. Disengaged from community life and unfortunately disengaged from family life as well.
I think that's the big one. That's where it starts. I mean, that's where the trouble comes in. We've done a pretty good job, right? I mean, you look at, families have really disintegrated first through no fault divorce. And now we just simply are abandoning the institution altogether by just not getting married in the first place, you know.
So, right.
So a lot of that's going on, and then of course we're not, talking about this in class the other day. The birth rates, right? Look at birth rates. Our birth rates are alarmingly low, and speak to, in some ways, our lack of concern for the future.
Right. You know, when we disconnect ourselves to the past and we disconnect ourselves to tradition, And not tradition necessarily from a community perspective, but family tradition. You know, we lose track of where we came from. We lose track of who great grandmother was and who great grandfather were and why they settled here and how they helped build, you know, the institutions and the cities that we live in a global world where, you know, we're moving three or four times within the course of our lifetime. We lose track of that. And when we lose track of that, we lose track of a sense of obligation to the future and a sense of obligation to the places we inhabit to, you know, continue those institutions or to continue building upon what's been built in the past. We've lost track of all of that. And we see ourselves as completely free. And as a matter of fact, I think globalization is intentionally trying to, quote unquote, free us from those obligations so that we can pursue, you know, our choices and our desires. The flip side of freedom is responsibility, and they go hand in hand.
Yes.
And I think globalization pushes us to kind of try to forget about that obligation side of it and just go for maximizing freedom.
Well, I think it also aligns with, again, I want to bring up Marx because Karl Marx, because again, globalization tends to its most prominent feature tends to be the sphere of economics. And remember, much of Marx's and his disciples' project, as you implement communism, is they disintegrate marriage, right? You have to get rid of marriage, and you have to get rid of family life, in order to create the utopian workers'
right.
paradise, because the emphasis is on the worker who is whose main, if not exclusive, relationship is to the state, not to a spouse and not to children.
Right, and part of why that came about is because of Marx's anthropology.
Correct.
He saw man as economic man. He saw man Correct. As completely dominated by trying to fulfill his desires, his wants, etc. And you know, the push for globalization in a lot of ways has adopted that same anthropology. And
yeah.
I think,
oh, yeah.
So a lot of the same problems that you saw of dissolving marriages and, you know, displacing communities and trying to get rid of those institutions that bind us to our, each other, to our neighbors, to our communities, to our homes. Marx tried to dissolve, and globalization is trying to dissolve it kind of from a different angle, but for the same reasons.
We need to take a break, and we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Listening to this radio was really like the jump start of me getting to know Jesus.
This is the station that led me to Christ.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle talking with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford. We are discussing globalization today. And we've now talked about how globalization comes from the standpoint of kind of a different understanding of the human person than Catholic thought would lead us. We've talked a little bit about how globalization tends to be kind of an acid that is dissolving parish life and family life and community life. And now let's talk a little bit about justice and the notion of justice, because the idea of justice has changed. One of our heroes on the show is Alistair MacIntyre, and his follow-up to After Virtue, which we've talked about quite a bit, was whose justice, which rationality?
Right.
And I think he brings that question to the fore of, we're dealing with very different definitions of justice.
We are. And that's it's such an important part of this discussion and even a wider discussion with the secular world, because often, to take a quick aside, secularism is often portrayed as sort of being neutral. And it's not. It's not because Each of us, regardless of, say, worldview or religious convictions, will bring to the table a set of understandings about some of the most important ideas that are out there. So understandings of justice, understandings of what it means to have a just society or have justice for oneself or collectively, what it means for equality, our understanding of what truth is and beauty, and these things, that these transcendentals that we've talked about, and these great ideas, as Mortimer Adler would point out. So we're in a contest of visions, we're in a contest of ideas, and it makes a difference on whose ideas prevail, because from the ideas will flow what? Principles and action. And so it's important that as Catholics, that we are, one, well-educated ourselves, steeped in the Catholic intellectual tradition, and then we're also prepared to engage others in, again, using diplomacy and tact, right? Not throwing the mashed potatoes at the Thanksgiving table, but rather with all due charity. People have to also know that that you care about them before they're willing to listen to you, especially if you have have a position that where I disagree with them. We enter into these conversations with charity first. But I want to go back to what you're talking about with justice, which is when we think about justice, there's a variety of different competing views out there. The one I think that's most dominant today justice is most closely associated with fairness. So it goes something like this. I know that I've achieved justice because the outcome is now fair. And how do I know if it's fair? Well, there I would say our tendency is to measure it in terms of equality. So, if you and I, Mark, we're going to, there's one donut here in the studio, we both want it. How do we achieve justice? Well, the method I think we would default to in our current setting would be, well, you cut it in half and you make two equal sized pieces. You get one and I get, you get one half and I get the other half. Justice has been achieved. That's one way. But a different way could be to take into something like needs. So, for example, it could be the case that you've not eaten at all today and I swung by Hardee's and had a delicious Frisco breakfast sandwich on my way in. And so when it comes to the donut, I should maybe have a much smaller piece of it, or maybe none at all,
right?
Based on your need.
You get the whole.
Right. You get the whole thing. So there's different ways, but notice, though, if you go away from anything, from justice, away from fairness being a measurement of measured by equality, there's harder work to be done. And I think that's why we kind of tend to avoid it. Because when you start trying to assess wants and needs and take into account particular situations and circumstances and backgrounds, you're all of a sudden got a lot of work ahead of you.
Right.
Where it's, if I just cut the darn thing in half, I'm done.
Right. And a lot of times equality leads to injustices as well. And I think that's a...
Yes, and people will not believe you when you say that.
Well, of course not, because I'm, because what we're talking about is definitions of justice, right? So
right.
If equality is your definition of justice, then it can't lead to injustice.
Right.
But there's an older definition of justice that a lot of Catholic thought is based upon, and that is the idea of right ordering.
Yes.
That a just society is one that is ordered properly.
Correct.
And there's levels of responsibility, there's levels of obligation, and each is answering and taking responsibility for its own sphere of what's right. So going back to your donut, a justly ordered social arrangement here to decide who gets the donut, need is probably going to play a large part of it, right?
Or it should.
But also health would play a large part of it.
Yes.
What's going to be beneficial for the health of those involved?
Maybe I hope that you're like, on a gluten-free thing.
Right, exactly.
And so I get the whole donut, even though you need it more.
Right, exactly. So if I were diabetic, for instance, right, then Justice would say, no, you know, Tim really ought to have the donut. But being able to take all those considerations into play involves an understanding of how things are ordered, but an understanding of what the whole looks like and what the whole ought to look like. And that ought that's involved mm-hmm. in there is teleology. And so I think there's a large amount of understanding the way the world ought to be that we can bring to the table from our Catholic tradition.
Yes. Teleology, that wonderful, based on that wonderful Latin word telos, where you use it for like a telescope, meaning sort of end, right? What's the purpose of these? What are they trying to achieve? What's the ideal state of affairs that we're trying to bring about?
Right. And how you understand this, once again, is through study of humanity, through study of the humanities, through study of history, through looking at what has worked in the past, what hasn't worked in the past. And, you know, as we said earlier, you know, that, of course, is anathema to our global economy.
Right.
You know, the global economy wants to push for economics, and they want to push for the STEM, you know, sciences. And they want to be pushing the boundaries so that we're, as Dr. Redpath, if he were on the show, you know, so that we're going to that ideal where we're torturing nature to reveal all of its secrets, so we can manipulate it and be right. Masters of nature. You know, yeah. that's the ideal. And as long
where does that come from, though? Where does that initial impulse come from?
I think it's, once again, a lack of understanding that humanity is part of nature, which comes mm-hmm. from the idea that we're created creatures. And by getting rid of that idea, we basically kind of lose the idea that we have limits and we have boundaries that are naturally set for mm-hmm. ourselves. And so if we can conquer nature, then we can overcome our boundaries. And you know, I think a lot of our politics revolves around the question of how best to do that. Is it best to do that by changing human nature so that we can change human nature and get rid of all the boundaries? Or is it best to do that by changing the external circumstances around us and getting rid of all the boundaries that are put in the place of science or put in the place of economics or put in the place of growth so that we can outgrow all of our limits? And, you know, I think a lot of our political discourse revolves around how is it best to get rid of limits, whereas limits are a reality. Limits are something we have to learn. We have to think about from a tradition of wisdom and, you know, kind of figure out, what is best for humanity as we are, you know, situated within this world. I'm off my soapbox now,
though. No, I think that's a great preview because, you know, we're an upcoming show by way of teaser. We're going to have a guest on that's going to help us kind of explore, especially when you talk about this idea of removal of boundaries, this removal of limits. Globalization, we've talked about, and one of its main objectives seems to be to erase national borders, erase senses of and establishment of communities and traditions. But you just brought us to a really interesting place, Mark, which is now what about now that we sort of turn those impulses on ourselves. And when we turn those impulses on ourselves, it's about eradicating human nature so that it's boundless. And you know where I see this emerging in a catastrophic manner is really around gender identity.
Yep.
This is where we've got deeply flawed philosophical as well as other disciplines pointing to some real trouble and confusion as it comes to gender. So we're going to have an upcoming show with a special guest that's going to help us kind of take a look at those issues.
Exactly. You know, that's one realm and area where this push for limitless freedom, pushing up against the boundaries, you know, the solution is to change our own individual human nature. I think in another sphere, we want to tend to try to change the nature of other human beings so that rather than being creations in and of themselves, you know, created in the image and likeness of God, they are created for my own whims and my own desires, and they become a boundary that I need to kind of, I need to get rid of the boundaries there between, me having to respect other people's humanity. I can put them at my service. I can use them as workers. I can use them as laborers. And that's really where the beginning of social justice from the Catholic tradition started. Industrialization was already in progress, and I think was kind of a preface of globalization.
Well, and I think that move that you're talking about, and we're just about out of time, is that fundamental move from the human person as subject to the human person as object.
Right.
And once we make that move to treating people as objects, then all sorts of evils flow from that.
Right. And I think we could probably dedicate an entire another show to a certain extent to,
let's do it,
what happens when we objectify our neighbors.
And that is all the time we have. We'll have to pick that one up at another show. Until then, God bless, and we'll see you next time. The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.